This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Hello everyone. Tanka ho.
Selamat datang.
Konnichiwa.
Hola.
안녕하세요.
Assalamu alaikum.
And kia ora.
Kia ora everyone. Welcome back to Connecting Cultures Features, a show by, for, and about the multicultural people of Dunedin in New Zealand. We have two lovely friends from Tuhura Otago Museum with us today. We have Tade and Leota with us. We have had lots of chats during Otago Polyfest, and I'm really excited to have them on the ORFM studios. Kia ora, talofa. Both of you.
Wow. Malo lava soifua moa male langi ma talofa. Yeah, that's me. That's Leota.
Kia ora koutou e whanau ma. It's great to be here today.
Yay. We might have a round of introductions so people know exactly who you are and what you do at Tuhura Otago Museum before we get to know you guys in a deeper level and we go way back. Leota, what's your role?
So my role is the Manager Pacifica Engagement at Tuhura Otago Museum. And what that means is, yeah, I'm your Pacific girl out there. So if there's anything in terms of Pacific or Pacifica that you would like to know or you'd like to engage with, I'm probably the one of the most ideal, if not the ideal person to connect with.
Yay. I'm glad we have the head of Pacifica community of Otago Museum here with us today to talk about.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us what exactly you're working on at the moment? What's your big project?
Our big project at the moment is the Pacific Cultural Gallery. So that's the current name, of course. Refresh. It's the refresh of the Pacific Cultural Gallery. For those who have been to the museum, Tuhura Otago Museum, the Pacific Gallery is currently or temporarily closed. The reason for that, the refurbishment, the upgrading, the reselection of artifacts by our communities, by our independent Pacific communities to have relevance, relations to the objects or artifacts going back into the gallery. So that's one of the avenues or part of the project that's going on at this time. And the other really cool part of it, you know, there's the overflow and the things we realize that becomes part of the project. For example, labeling, ensuring that we have both our respective ethnic languages to the Taoka, to our Pacific treasures, as well, of course, the scientific or the Western name for it. Mm. You know what? I just found out today they have a whole museum talk and research as to, and they even have a fancy name about this process, and that's being highlighted in museums around the world. Wow. And here we are, you know, as it evolves, this project evolves, thinking it's just common sense. Or it's just something that, yeah, we need to do. And part of that evolution of this work is all to do with respecting the knowledge and the people who have taken their time be part of this project, be part of this community, and again, come back to respect, relevancy, reciprocity, all those really lovely words. Mm.
Sounds like a really big project that is happening in your space. And yeah, we'll keep in touch to hear more about any updates around the refresh of the Pacifica space.
We're looking at about February, March 2026 for the reopening. So let you know right now, ORFM listeners, you are all welcome. And I am looking forward to what it is that we also have on the menu.
Ah, oh,
on the menu.
That's very specific.
Simply because, you know, for Pacifica, it's all about, you know, part of the cultural aspect is about how we serve and what we serve our peoples. Yeah. And that's not just Pacific, but Dunedin community.
Tane, do you want to tell us about what you do at Tuhura?
Kia ora, yeah. So my name's Tane. I whakapapa to kaitahu, kati mamoe, waitaha, and tūhoi. At Tuhura Otago Museum, I am their collections technician, Māori. So I work a lot with our toka Māori and with our communities and weaving the two together.
Can you tell us when you started your role recently?
Yeah. I started my role about 4 or 5 months ago, so it was quite recent. I was previously the curator Māori for Southland Museum. My next thing that I need to do is get more professional development in the museum space. And so I decided to make the move to Dunedin and pestered Tuhura Otago Museum for a little bit and finally got the job. So, Yay. Yeah, that's awesome.
And we are very lucky to have you as part of the team of Tuhura Otago Museum. How are you finding Dunedin so far?
Oh, fantastic. I was here maybe 3 or so years ago. I spent about 4 years here, 3 years ago, so to speak, for university. So it's sort of like a homecoming in a way. And I was born here as well. So I have quite a good connection with Otiportia Dunedin. So, it's just great to be back and great to meet up with old friends and make those connections again and, transverse Dunedin and see what it has to offer.
So technically Dunedin is home.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yep. Okay, that's good that you're coming back and you're here now. I think this is a really good time to travel back with our guests, and that's what we do here on Connecting Cultures Features. Can you tell us a bit about where you grew up and what life was like back then?
You know, for Tane, he doesn't have to go back much, but in my situation, oh my goodness, you stop counting.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is you stop counting those things called age numbers. Yeah.
Birthdays.
Yeah, that's enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Get a certain number and then, So, background for me, I'm Samoa and I affiliate also to Tonga. From Samoa, I'm from Veimoso, people of the Mau. So that means those who were part of the Samoa independence movement and housed the office of the independence movement, the Mau movement. And my leota is my matai or chiefly title that comes from Eva Anua Ma'a. Upolu, and so that's the name that I've decided to use here in Dunedin, and also, of course, throughout my work in honor of my family, in honor of what it was, the commitment that I agreed to as part of who I am, and how I'm associated. And of course, in the latter days, I grew up in South Auckland, Otara, 274. And I schooled there, I went to college, and love or hate it, people, Macaulay High School, still the winners of the Polyfest. Auckland Poly Fest, okay.
I love that you're keeping tabs.
Of course. And I'm very blessed and fortunate to also have schooled with some very current and influential women, Pacifica women, who are making changes in their spaces, especially in politics, both national and local politics. So that's probably a bit about me. My family, my siblings, you know, like I'm the eldest. So in the Tongan society, I'm the whahu. In the Samoan society, I'm just the server. and that's probably more me. And my background more so is community. I've always been a community person, joining and creating or developing those sexy cool words that they use, developing, creating, community groups. For different projects for the welfare of Pacific peoples, especially in South Auckland. Yeah.
So you are from Samoa.
Yes.
You moved to South Auckland.
Yes.
How old were you when you did that move?
I was probably under 5 years old.
So you came with your family.
Yes.
Why did you come to South Auckland?
Like many, the story was always about education, a better life. My parents were influenced around just some form of stability. They were young. My parents would have been in their 20s. They were young and just were buying into the stories that were told and I think, too, they were inspired to seek a new life, seek changes. And during the 70s, it would have been very much a dramatic time of change.
Mm.
Yeah, you know, we're not as held to certain, or we think we're not held to certain social discriminations or social issues. But of course, you know, the reality was it became worse in that time frame.
So it was your parents, you and your siblings.
That's right.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you remember about coming to New Zealand at that age? And also, did you feel any different growing up in South Auckland? I imagine South Auckland being more diverse than, you know, Otipoti Dunedin, where I'm used to.
Oh, very diverse. During the time that growing up in Otara, it was still farmland. So, you know, you lived across the farm. There was hardly any bus routes going up the hill. There was only one school, Flatbush Primary. And college, Hillary College at the time was nowhere near us. It was in another part of Otara and Tangaroa College, but that came a bit after. And school was very diverse. And I think the strongest thing that I recall from my cousins, older cousins who attended the schools, even actually all of us, we were English second language.
Mm.
So at home, we all spoke our Samoan language. And of course, church became a feature in our lives, making sure our faith, our spirituality, but also hindsight, you realize it was one of our social spaces where it was safe for us to congregate, to communicate, to engage, and have common purpose before, of course, you watch your parents get up at, you know, before 5 in the morning to go out into this darkness, into the cold and work. And so families, we had 5 other families, like my cousins, they had 6-7 kids.
Mm.
And so it's always left to the eldest of our cousins to babysit for us. So imagine the number of kids at that time in that household. And while all our parents would work and coming to New Zealand, one of the things I recall the most is you get the state house, right? And you're so, wow, this is, you know, flasher than living in a rented place in central Auckland, which was pretty much rotten floors, poor quality, paying all this money with overcrowding. And you move into the state house, brand new, but it was cold as hay. It was cold. Mm. And only to discover later on that none of those houses were insulated, that the way in which it was built, you know, they were poorly built. And yet we were to pay for the, you know, all the, an upgrade as we went along and lived there. So
thinking about growing up there, did you know you wanted to be involved in community just from a very young age, being involved with church and also your people?
Absolutely. I was very blessed and I was surrounded by some real movers and shakers of the, in the space of, you know, they'll call them activists, they'll call them all these troublemakers. And they were both Pacific, Māori, and non-Pacific. And so you grow up with these leaders, even David Longhi. I didn't even realize that it was David Longhi, you know, until he became prime minister and he was this hotshot guy. But he had an office. Most of them operated out of Ōtara. So they had a Labour Party office out there. It was also our community centre, law centre. And you would grow up along with these people. My mother was a secretary, and they formed their Samoan community or, you know, official community group. All those different types of groups and people, I believe, influenced my just what would become a natural progression, especially seeing injustice, hearing about injustice against our Pacific peoples and just even Māori neighbours, you know. Dawn raids were still going. People think it ended in the 70s. Oh, no, no, no. You know, my significant dawn raid experience other than the 70s was up to 1985. The police were still doing the dawn raids, knocking on the doors, getting it wrong, or just for random reasons coming through and scaring my grandparents, you know, who didn't speak English, didn't understand what was going on. And it was kind of sad because, you know, their first thoughts was, oh, has my son, has my grandchild done something wrong as to why the police are, you know, police are here, or who are you looking for, and all those types of scenarios. And, yeah, so that's probably why it is that my love for community and especially Pacific, as in, I don't feel comfortable using those terms that we often hear, like advocate and, but just,
It's normal to your families.
I think taking the Samoan term of serving, serving my community, given the skills, given the opportunities afforded to me to be able to help make a difference or support change. this one's not as strong, but along those lines, advocacy is probably the best word for it. But to serve our people, because that's what you're told and that's what you hear when you have a religious background, but also a cultural background, service. Service for our people, service to those who need it. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. To serve.
Thank you for sharing that background. And I think it's important to know what drives you. And that's a very important part of your growing up and childhood. It is who makes you today, so that's good.
Some might say a sucker because, too much of a volunteer need to do the balance of your life and get paid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So part of that volunteer part came, also then motivated you look around and you volunteer to assist and help others. And you realize that those that you have been helping have also been able to make their changes. And whether you like it or not, a little bit of qualifications from the Western world to support in the Western eyes or the Western lens that you actually know what you're talking about. And going back to those who are actually shoulder tapping may not be the kindest word, but to re-engage with those that you have helped in the past or present with their journey in the Western mm-hmm. world to become the leaders of their fields, that in itself is also relevant to the work and the support that you need in looking for opportunities that you don't quite realize are out there. That's why I'm at the museum, and never did I ever think be mm-hmm. at a museum, right? What am I doing at a museum? Only to walk into the world of museum and land before me, lo and behold, are my ancestral connections.
Mm.
Mersina that you may read about, that you hear about, but to see, to feel, that whole see, feel, touch, wow, that's mind-blowing. And then you find out that not many of our people have ever come into our museum, then in itself becomes a mission. Yeah.
I wonder if Tane feels that way as well. But yeah, let's talk about what it was like for you growing up in Dunedin as a Maori person, making your way to Invercargill and coming back.
Yeah, kia ora. So, as Leota says, we don't have to go as far as what she does back in time. But it's actually around 24 years ago, and I'm 25 and 9 days, so, not very long at all. I was born in Otipoti, Dunedin. My parents briefly stayed up here. My mum was pregnant with me as a premature baby, so they were over at the hospital. And then 1st of November, a Wednesday. So, here comes along me in 2000, and pretty much straight away it was on an ambulance back down to Invercargill. And I spent quite a wee while there in their neonatal at Invercargill Hospital. That's where my family typically resided. So though born in here, born at Otipoti, I grew up basically down in Waihopai, Invercargill. What was life back then? That's not so long ago. So, If within living memory.
See, I told you. Yeah. I could have breathed this guy, okay?
You grew up in Invercargill. Tell me about Invercargill.
Yeah, Invercargill's Invercargill, you know, bottom of the south, except for Bluff, but, you know, sort of windy, raining. That's pretty much the how life was like. Yeah. Not much sun, but then when the sun came out, it was lovely. So, Invercargill's Invercargill. I mean, yeah, it was an all right place to grow up, I think. We had beautiful Ariti Beach right at our fingertips that we could, you know, a short drive away. We had all the rivers which we could easily get access to and go fishing and, you know, swimming and, life was sweet.
So that's your lifestyle?
Yeah.
Cool. Yep. Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have one half-brother, Caden Stevens, and, he's 18 now, so I'm sort of preparing for his big change in life, and, he was born in 2006, I think. It was bit of a surprise when he came around, but I was just so happy to have, a brother that I have someone else,
yes.
You know, someone else to play with, someone else to look after. And, we look after each other, really. So, it's great having a younger sibling and that tuakana taina role. And,
So thinking about growing up in your whānau in Invercargill, what was it like for you being there with your communities, with did you have a big family?
We actually have a big family in a way, but a lot of us are spread out all across Aotearoa, New Zealand. So we were sort of quite a small hapu, if you will, only really grew up around immediate family. My mother and my father split when I was about three, so I got two birthdays and two Christmases, so to speak. So that was, good fun. Being fair-skinned Māori, we didn't really get subjected to any of the racism which is prevalent down there. So we were living pretty sweet because we could pass as Pākehā. So, we didn't really have a lot of the struggles as what some of our whānau do.
Thank you for acknowledging your privilege there. But besides that, did you feel any different growing up?
Yeah, I certainly felt different. I felt it more connected to the whenua, more connected to the moana, just like this inner sense of connection. I did feel a bit different because I'm fair-skinned myself, my parents aren't, so I saw a lot of the racism more so directed at them than myself. As a kid, you don't really understand what that means and what that is, so yeah, I didn't understand it at the time, and in a sad sense, I thought it was normal.
Mm.
I mean, I thought, oh yeah, no, that's what growing up is,
and that's how people treat people.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Because of course, as a young tamariki, you are shaped by the environment that you live in, and that was the environment that I lived in, and I didn't know any better. And it wasn't until, later on in life through high school and I went to Verdon College, a Catholic school, and that's when I started to become more aware of both my whakapapa Māori but also of institutional racism and sort of how our whānau tools and mechanisms for a whānau to deal with that weren't really valuable. So it was sort of, that side of things we wasn't really talked about. It was, sort of everyday life. So you really didn't, yeah, you really didn't, you weren't able to do much about it, and that was the environment that you were growing up in. Yeah.
And when you realised that was the case? And
yeah, I mean, even then when I went to university, I mean, as, you know, being quite fair-skinned, the institutional racism was still present. And a lot of people would come up to you and say, oh, I bet you're on a Maori scholarship, and, you know, that's using that sort of language, and say, oh, we don't agree that you're on a Maori scholarship and our children can't get scholarships and all the rest of it. And while I was at university studying geology, history and archaeology, in the 4 years that I was there, I never once learnt a purako, a traditional story about the whenua that I was working with, the whenua that I was on. So I was still quite heavily disconnected from my whānau hapū iwi. But again, because I'd grown up in that sense, in that environment, I didn't know better. So it was normal to me. It was normal. And, you know, the comments about, oh, well, you're on a Māori scholarship. I mean, I just didn't bat an eyelid at it. I just thought, oh, yeah, that's, you know, that people will be people and some people are like that, you know. And it wasn't until, so after university, I left university about 2022 with a bachelor's of science, and I went back to home to Invercargill, spent about 6 months or so just, you know, relaxing after a whirlwind of 4 years, during the height of the pandemic as well, and sort of, you know, waiting for calmer waters and the world to quiet down. And so, yeah, I spent 6 months with whānau in Invercargill, and it took that whole 6 months to find a job, which was quite difficult, certainly in the environment that we had, you know, just coming out of a global pandemic. But I eventually got a job at Hokonui Runaka, working in their freshwater Taiyo team as a environmental advisor. So I was then brought into Te Ao Māori. And that's where I started to understand what I was experiencing was racism, and that's not okay. And that's when I started to realise, you know, it's not all right. That's what I was experiencing right throughout my childhood. And at the same time, it was really good because through Hokonui Runaka, I was able to connect more to my iwi, find my whānau and my hapū, connect back and register to Ngāi Tahu and register to my Runaka as well, which was exciting and also scary at the, you know, going to the first whānau meeting and you're sitting beside all your cousins and, you know, talking about real hard subjects and trying to make all these decisions, and it was like, oh wow, it's quite a new, different world, but a world that just felt like home, that it had always been there, that I had always belonged, and it was just waiting for the time that I was given the opportunity to connect back. So yeah, I greatly appreciate all the mahi that Hokonui Runaka continue to do and have done, and especially in helping me find my iwi, find my hapū and connect to it, and they continue to support me on my journey. Aww. So yeah.
That's so special, you know, just recovering and finding your whānau. What's the process like? How does one find their whānau?
Yeah, it's quite difficult because, as I say, you know, being fair-skinned and not brought up in that community, you do feel a little bit like an outsider. But at the same time, I was slowly starting to pick up on who my whānau was, what home meant to me, what whānau itself meant to me, through researching my whakapapa. And it's that I began to slowly connect, and Hokonui Runaka were a strong pusher of that connection. And, it's really, to me, once I found my marae, once I first registered with Ngāi Tahu, my mother helped me with that. And then I found our runaka, and then I, put in a email inquiry, which is like a real basic thing to do, but an email inquiry and say, hey, I'm Tane, this is my whakapapa, and I want to connect back. And then, and that really opened up the doors to be like, and they were like, you come into our whare nui, bring your whānau and connect back. And and then they brought out the whakapapa and showed me how to use the Ngāi Tahu Research Centre and the Ngāi Tahu Whakapapa Unit to do more research into my whakapapa, connect with the cousins. And it was and it still is an ongoing thing, today I was down at the Hocken Library scanning some of my whakapapa, which is in taproots, the whakapapa of Whareitutu Newton and George Newton, who I whakapapa back to. Our whānau didn't manage to get a copy of the book when it was published in the 80s, I think, but we are in it. And so for quite a long time, I was trying to find a copy of the book to scan, and I think it's something like 250 pages. So that was my morning today. Ah. But through there, Whareitutu had over 6,000 descendants recorded in the 80s. You can only imagine how that number has grown now. But it's a really valuable starting point of any whānau research because it's got all the names, all the whakapapa, and you can follow it back and then you can follow it forwards to new descendants and then go from there and, contact your whānau and be like, hey, did you know I exist? And, connect back to them and, talk to them, find out more. To find your whakapapa, to find your whānau, it's a lifetime of research. It's a lifetime of connecting. It's a lifetime of an ongoing mission.
Yes, it sounds like that's, your star that you're looking towards.
Yeah.
How does it feel now with knowing this whole new world and relearning everything that's important to you?
It feels so awesome. I mean, it's such a supportive community. They really drive you and inspire you to do your best, to follow your passions, follow your dreams. It's an amazing community to be in, and it feels, having been disconnected, but it feels like home, So it doesn't feel any different. Yeah.
Yeah. This is interesting for me because I'm thinking of a lot of our Pacific connections and, our Pacific whakapapa. It's an interesting one for me because we're in reverse. And we, regardless of the Western education that we have about recording things, we're not. And so the only time we're caring about the recording of our whakapapa is to actually, the motivation mostly is about land ownership. It's not about belonging. It's about land ownership. And I'm talking when I'm thinking about, Samoa in particular. So having a place which can record our own ngafa or whakapapa is important. And yet the only one I know that works for us other than having to subscribe on MyHeritage, and that is the Church of Latter-day Saints genealogy website. I'm looking at him because he's a genealogist. Oh, no.
The other one.
The other one. Yeah, that G-O word. But yes, and I suppose what I'm thinking about is sometimes the complacency of those of us who think we know and will always know, yet will come a time, if not even today, we don't know. So taking the tools of today to actually create something is vitally important. Yeah.
Are you tracking your whakapapa?
Yes, but not consistently. My whakapapa word or my ngafa, believe it or not, is through the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints genealogy. And simply because it seems a lot more easier to access and I don't have to pay for it. And there does not seem to be a specific website as such or a village type for such. Everyone tries to maintain or what's the word when you hide it, prefer not to share because of the fallout of these other consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know that in the future, people die, people come, and those things, land remains, unless, of course, you get climate change.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of options that can happen in the future. But I'm really happy to learn this side of you, Tane, and all the best for your journey.
Yes, thanks.
I feel like there's so much. Like, you should start writing a book just from everything you will keep learn about yourself. Mm. I hope you are keeping tabs on everything as well.
The amount of my salary that I spend on whakapapa is honestly crazy. Mm. Our whānau holds a lot of our whakapapa information. My two Ngāti Pākehā grandmothers kept an amazing record of everything. E te tau o tōku tūhoi, e te tau o tōku kaitahu. And they hold a lot of that information. And because my auntie and I are the holders of our whānau whakapapa, we're together in a process of reclaiming it. And going through all that paperwork, going through all the photographs, putting a name to the faces and cataloguing and doing more research. And at home in my office, I've got about 5 archive boxes. Being a museum professional, it's all conservation grade custom cardboard boxes and folders and leaflets and everything. I still have bags and bags and bags of handwritten letters from whānau, handwritten diaries from whānau, wow, photographs. So, it's an ongoing journey, and you learn something new every day. Yeah.
Glad you're making use of your work personality at home as well.
Yep, very much so. I mean,
office.
Yeah. Well, one of the deals of mum and I moving up here was that I would get a third bedroom. Uh-huh. So mum has a bedroom, I have a bedroom, and I have a second bedroom to use as my office. So, it's really valuable to have that opportunity, to have a space where I can have all my pukapuka, all my books, where I can have all my whakapapa, where I can have all my archives in the one place. But our home is also an open home. So it's a valuable there for whānau to come and visit, to borrow books, to borrow archives, to research their own whakapapa, to have a look at some of our tauka that we have from whānau within our whakapapa. I work in a museum, right? And, tauka Māori is my passion. Kōhatu rocks are my passion. And, there's just so many things to do, so many research interests that it doesn't feel like mahi because it is what I am inspired by it is what I do. And so, of course, in my spare time, if you will, that is my work. That is what I still do. So that's why I have an office, you know, that I can go to and continue to do my research, to continue to pull my passions together.
How lucky to get paid to love doing something, yeah.
It's so good.
Just jumping back into recalling my growing up here in especially in South Auckland, the names. So you have what I call code names. So you have a Samoan name when you go through the door at home. You come out, you have a Parangi or a Pākehā name to go to school. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the names that your friends call you because they can't pronounce your name.
So what are your names?
No, too hard.
This is a safe space.
Yeah, exactly, the safe space. But, Leota is, of course, my Maatai title. Atlas is my Western world name. And Elesi is my Samoan name. And Teresa is my Catholic middle name. Code names, eh? And of course, wrap it all up with Meredith. Now, can you imagine, right, going to school or to places and your name is Alice Meredith and everyone's anticipating someone who looks like Tane?
Yeah.
And asking you several times if you are who you say you are, and or asking if your surname is you're supposed to be your first name. And the best one, you know, as you get older is, did you marry a Meredith person?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to anticipate that Meredith is actually now renowned in the Pacific as a Samoan surname.
Wow. Fun fact.
Yeah, because only Merediths are in Samoa, from Samoa. Don't worry about Wales. Yeah. Meredith's of the Pacific come from Samoa.
See, that's a really interesting point that you have, Leota, because, I mean, you get my name, Tane Tamati, and you would expect someone like Leota, yet, you know, I'm quite a fair-skinned Māori, if you will. It's just the stereotypes. And, you know, when I went through high school, in school and, you know, growing up, I didn't really think twice about the name because I was fair passing, if you know what I mean. It's just because of those stereotypes, right, which is just so wrong, but they exist. And
it's the norm. It becomes the norm in terms of, you know, in hindsight now, or, you know, when we reflect, or the whatever the cool word for that is, you realize,
reminisce.
Yeah, that's the one. When we reminisce, you realize, yeah, no, no, that was not appropriate.
Yeah, that sounds traumatizing. Oh, wow.
Just like getting caught, you know, go back, you coconuts, and then being caught a fob, which means fresh off the boat. And then, you know, the other normality, you then face each other and call each other fobs.
Yeah.
We ourselves call each other fobs, fresh off, or call ourselves coconuts. Only now, if we hear those terms, we're like, either a want-to-fight situation or a standoff, just literally a standoff. But before it was okay.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So it's interesting to see this perspective of names and how, you know, there's quite parallels and differences between your two experiences, but they all come to one thing, racism.
Yes.
Yeah. So with your roles, so, you know, you work with Tauka and also connect with communities. What do you hope Māori and Pacifica people feel when they visit the museum. And yeah, and you two are such passionate people when it comes to museum. Tell us, what do you want from the community?
Excitement. I want them to feel excited to be in the space, exciting to feel the connections to Ka Tupuna, you know, feel connected to their culture, to Te Ao Māori. And I want them to feel that it's a welcoming space for them. I mean, I acknowledge we've got mahi to do. We've got mahi to do, but that's what I want them to feel, that excitement, the same passion that Leota and I both have for our heritage.
Mm. And it's every time I hear that question, you know, first I have to stop myself from wanting to cry, because, you know, to get to the point of Tane, we have to... What I want our community, you know, want for our community is to come, to feel safe, to literally come through the door. But, you know, for that excitement and everything, it's understanding the why. It's also understanding and unpacking the relationship of what is being held. A bit of a side one, but when I first arrived here to Dunedin and I shared with our community that I am the Pacific person here at the museum, they were quite surprised in a positive way. And I was quite surprised myself, because the same comment of, we have been waiting for you.
Oh.
Exactly. We've been waiting for you. And I'm thinking, I've never met these people. I do not have family here in Dunedin. I've never been to Dunedin until I landed here. And to meet different individuals who, upon hearing that I was being placed at Te Huhura, said, we've been waiting for you. And I looked and thought, oh my God, what if I, do I know these people? What are they talking about? And that has been part of the mission, part of the inspiration of my work. And the reasoning behind that is understanding and being able to get to a place of which, you know, Tane has mentioned, to be excited, to find its relevance, to find its purpose, and the purpose being that we belong. We belong, we already belong in Wananiwiakiwa. We were already here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We already have things of our ancestors that we know about. And thank you, Te Huhura, places like Te Huhura Otago Museum and other museums. Thank you for looking after it. But now let me come and re-educate you all about what these objects, what these artifacts actually mean, because, by the way, they come from where I'm from. They were made by people like me, that cultural knowledge, and sharing it with those who have their academic knowledge, who have their Western knowledge. How cool is that? That relationship.
Thank you so much, both of you, for being here today to share about your work. I am sure there will be more chats in the future. Thank you so much. Ka kite.
Ka kite anō.
Tō whāsoi fua.
Thanks for listening to Connecting Cultures Features on RFM.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.